This is part 9 of The Horse and the Rider. It's one story that begins with part 1, so if you haven't heard that, go back. And the Rider, Part 9, The Fellowship. Peter Quinnell Live and Jackie sat on the timber bench in the winter silence and stared out at the orange floodlights gleaming off the tracks and the chain-link fence. At the boundary of the rail yard, the light was absorbed by rows of black trees. It was a clear night, and even through the corona of the brightly lit platform, Peter and Jackie could see the deep blue of the night sky and the almost full moon.
"Why are we going to Albury?" Peter asked.
Jackie thought for a moment and said, "I'm going to meet a friend." She let the answer hang in the air in the hopes Peter would be too intimidated to ask any more questions.
"A friend?" he replied eagerly. "Who's the friend? An old friend? Have you been to Albury before?"
It was irritating, but there was nothing else to do on a lonely train station with 45 minutes to wait, so she told him how she'd never been to Albury, and not an old friend, but a very new one, and one she'd never met before, and her name was Leanne. Peter was gratified that his new companion was beginning to develop rapport with him. It was a point of pride. He was fond of imagining himself as a kind of charming wayfarer, able to insert himself into any social or professional interaction and build trust and friendship, no matter how difficult or unwilling the other parties were. It was an essential delusion. In reality, he was brittle and fearful around people he didn't know. Awkward, arrogant, and dismissive. But to acknowledge any of it would be at odds with the professional personality he'd worked so hard to cultivate. It was true that TV news viewers wanted to trust the anchors they watched from their living rooms every night, and the type of personality they trusted was smooth and in charge. They wanted a man who really was the master of any conversation he chose to dip a toe into, whether the conversation was with a politician or a shifty tradesman. And Peter understood that the most authentic way to have them believe him in that role was to believe it himself, so he did.
"Tell me more about Leanne," he urged Jackie.
"She works for a magazine," Jackie said, "about boats." She thought about what else she could tell Peter about Leanne, and she realised she couldn't think of anything. She felt a bit ashamed about it. She didn't want to tell him more, but it felt disrespectful to Leanne to have nothing more to say. The main reason why Jackie had little to share about Leanne was that she knew little about Leanne. At this point, Leanne was largely theoretical, but a theory that was seductive. It was nice to have something going with someone new after Jeannie, particularly someone with ambition, with a hobby, whose lively conversation and spicy text messages made her realise how much had been missing from her previous relationship. The cold morning that Jeanette had broken up with her remained as insulting now as it was shocking at the time. She'd leapt out of bed in disoriented panic as the woman with a cold, blank expression stood, arms crossed, holding open the bedroom door.
"Why? Jeannie, come on, babe, what's going on?" Jackie stammered at her.
She stared blankly out the front door at the dew on the cold lawn.
"Come on, Jeannie, let's talk about it,"
Jackie continued in a tremulous voice, still a little bit thick and throaty from sleep.
"Don't make this harder than it needs to be, Jack," Jeanette mumbled.
"Oh, don't make this harder than it needs to be, Jack," Jackie sneered back, mentally processing as she did so whether it was worth making it harder than it needed to be.
A chilly gust swirled in the front door and nibbled at her pajama pants. Well, okay, she thought. It's not like she'd set her heart on a forever with Jeanette, and in fact, when she searched her heart, she found a non-zero quantity of relief that it was she who had assumed the burden of breaking up. But the early morning eviction stung, and she felt moved to pull the knife from her side and push it into Jeanette's.
"Why shouldn't I make it hard, Jeanette, when you've just made my life hard? Look at me, standing out in the cold like a dog, Where have you been all night? Why don't we talk about your lousy fucking job? Where do you go all the time? What would your mum think about you if she knew you thought it was okay to pull people out of bed and push them out onto the street?
But Jeanette didn't say anything, just pulled up the hood of her Carhartt jumper, tucked her dirty hands into the front pouch pocket, and stood by the door. It was cold and she was half asleep, but Jackie found an old backpack in a wardrobe and stuffed into it some undies, a toothbrush, a book she'd left on the bedside table. She stumbled around for 5 minutes looking for the things she'd bought and left in the house they'd shared, until Jeanette's silent posting by the door became too oppressive to bear. Jackie told her,
"You're a bitch, you know that, you're an asshole."
She didn't say anything, so Jackie stomped on her foot. Jeanette winced and stared over her head, and that did it. Jackie's vision globbed up with huge, stupid tears, and she pushed past Jeanette into the bright morning light and forgot what came next. Jeanette shut the door behind her. She trawled the house methodically for everything worth anything and packed it into her semi-trailer. She dropped the keys at the real estate agents and moved to the Central Coast, where she joined a cult called the Fellowship of the Star of Five Meridians and never wrote back to Jackie's texts again. The Fellowship of the Star of Five Meridians was a cult, but just barely. It was started in 1987 by two families, the Hansons and the Pratts, who owned adjoining blocks of land on Wyong Creek. The couples of Christine and Rod Hanson and Louise and Victor Pratt found in one another a potent combination of spirituality and rabid ambition. They built cabins at the border of their properties and cleared a patch of bush to install a football field. They hosted the local football teams free of charge, with a sausage sizzle at the end of each Saturday morning game with competitively priced food and refreshments. To the parents and kids who came, they passed out napkins printed with their odd-looking logo, a horizontal half-circle, overlaid with a five-pointed star, intersected with dotted lines. They made jocular small talk with the parents of the football children, who participated politely, until the fellowship's themes of nature and judgment became too abstruse, and then excused themselves. Their own children, Alex and Stephen Hansen, and Kimmy, Jasmine, Ben and Elise Pratt, wore the most expensive surf brands because their parents knew that popularity among children can be bought with the right currency. They wore Billabong and Roxy in hopes that the other children would persuade their parents to join the fellowship. For five football seasons, they continued their soft pitch. By the end, the Fellowship of the Star of Five Meridians had no additional members. Alex Hansen turned 18 and bought four small marijuana plants from a kid at school and planted them off a small track he'd beaten through an acre of bush on his parents' property. In the soft, rich earth, the plants grew enthusiastically. He dried bundles of the stuff in a dark corner of his dad's shed and sold it at school. He grew more and sold more. And one evening, nearly a year later, an impressionable 25-year-old stoner named Scott Pendleton crawled down the Hansons' driveway and knocked on the door.
"Alex has gone out," Christine told him.
"Who is it, hun?"
Rod called from the kitchen.
"Scott," Scott said. "Do you know where he keeps his weed?"
Christine and Rod were only slightly surprised to learn that their son was a marijuana entrepreneur, but thrilled at this gift of a guileless young man who needed something they had. They told him they were sure it was around somewhere and invited him in.
"Beer?"
Rod asked.
"Okay," Scott said.
They sat him down on the couch with a cold beer and asked him about himself.
"It's so wonderful to know that our Alex has such handsome friends," Christine winked at him.
"Thanks," Scott said.
They told him that as a token of their gratitude for befriending Alex, the weed on his return would be free of charge for his trouble.
"I'm sure you have somewhere you need to be," Rod ventured. "Not really," Scott said.
They asked him if he'd ever heard of the Fellowship of the Star of Five Meridians, and he said no, and they shook their heads and said that was a shame, because young men like him were whom it was all about. "Strong young men," Christine said.
"In touch with nature," Rod added,
"who value the God-given bounty of everything that can be grown and harvested." Scott nodded. He understood. They explained that it was a new type of spirituality whereby if you worked hard and did what was asked of you by the leadership, you could have everything you wanted.
"What kind of things do you like?" Christine asked.
Scott thought about it.
"Xbox," he said.
"You can have Xbox,"
Rod confirmed.
"Smoking cones," Scott said.
"You can smoke cones," Rod confirmed.
"Chicks,"
Scott said. Rod looked at Christine. She nodded furiously.
"You can have chicks," Rod announced.
Scott sat up.
Okay, he said. What do I have to do?
Christine swooped in. It's so easy, she chirped. The first thing is move in, and that's free of charge, of course, and the next thing is just do whatever the leadership asks you to do.
Who's the leadership? Scott asked.
Well, that's Rod and I, Christine told him. Scott nodded and said he'd think about it. Christine fixed him a cocktail of Sprite, red wine and bourbon, which was all they had in the cupboard, while Rod rifled frantically through Alex's bedroom for some marijuana. They both knew the future of the fellowship hung in the balance. After some time, Rod re-emerged holding aloft a small Ziploc bag with a half a dozen pre-rolled joints.
I wanted cones, Scott protested,
but he lit one up anyway, and half an hour later his head slumped forward asleep. Rod and Christine tucked his legs up on the couch and spread a blanket over him. The next morning, when he awoke at around 11, Rod had already driven to the JB Hi-Fi at Erin Affair and bought an Xbox. Christine fed him some eggs and at the end handed him another Ziploc bag stuffed with marijuana. Scott moved into one of the cabins later that day. He smoked cones and played Xbox in the morning, and in the evening he went to work at Coles stacking shelves. He stole food and brought it home to the fellowship, and after a while he became comfortable with the idea of handing his fortnightly wages over to Rod and Christine. The Nightfill staff at the supermarket was full of bored young men and women, and they found Scott's lifestyle appealing. More of them moved into the cabins. The word spread. Rod began doing a nightly minibus run to the Coles car park. One night, a freight truck driver unloading pallets onto the dock overheard some of the young workers talking about the fellowship. You just hang out and smoke and play Xbox? She wanted to know. And some lady cooks for you? They told her she was correct.
So what do you have to do? She asked.
Everyone looked to Scott.
Oh, nothing, Scott said. It's just chill. You just got to get into it. You just listen to what they tell you, he shrugged. It's actually pretty sick.
He explained, when you die, you follow the star of five meridians, and it leads you to the base of a vast white cliff. And on the cliff, there's a ledge. And you shout to God, and he comes out and judges your soul and tells you if you're going to heaven or hell. It's not just being a Christian, because you have to respect his bounty in all forms. And when you die, you have to find him. You don't just get automatically transported to heaven, like there's an escalator.
If you're cool with that, it's happy days, he finished.
He'd be rewarded if he brought a new follower back to the fellowship. It sounded pretty good to Jeanette, so she drove home and broke up with Jackie and moved into one of the cabins and was happy for several years until the cult's finances broke down and the followers, broke and unemployable, were launched into the welfare system. In desperation, Jeanette signed up for a medical trial in which she was infected, then cured, of typhoid fever. For every time she was infected with typhoid fever and cured, she was given $5,000. After a few rounds, she noticed a new plumpness to her skin and a thickness and shine to her hair. She began to post photos of herself on social media. She found the voice and persona of beauty influencers came to her naturally and rapidly amassed an audience of several hundred thousand followers and the advertisers who came with them. She received her typhoid fever infection, remained for observation in the clinic for a few days, then was cured. She headed straight from the clinic to the airport and within hours was on a beach in Koh Samui for one slimming tea photo shoot or another. The cycle continued for 2 years before the medical trial came to a conclusion. Within weeks, Jeanette's skin became dry, thin and creased again. Her hair receded and greyed. New photo shoots were not possible. Gradually, Jeanette's backlog of photos taken at the height of her good health dwindled. She became desperate. She began experimenting with combinations of bacteria in an effort to contract typhoid fever naturally. But her experiments only led to several bouts of botulism. Months passed. She contacted the scientists she'd worked with on the trial at home and offered them first money, then threats of violence in exchange for more doses of the disease and cure. Her inept efforts at blackmail were handed over to the police, and she was sentenced to 5 years in prison, where she died. She never saw Jackie again. Sailing, Jackie elaborated to Peter. Leanne's into recreational boats, like yachts, not fishing boats. Maybe if she just said what she knew, she'd remember things along the way. She's got her own boat. She's been working on it for months. It had holes in it. She's trying to get it seaworthy so she can sail it. Peter chuckled indulgently.
Albury's nowhere near the sea,
he told her in a tone he hoped was generous and comradely.
She's going to sail it on the river,
Jackie told him sternly. The term seaworthy is used to describe any vessel's capacity to travel across water. Her change in tone surprised him, and he looked off into the air in shame. Above them, a swarm of bats flocked and circled, and for a moment seemed to take the silhouette of an enormous skull, its jaw locked open in a silent scream, a plume of glowing dust emitting from its mouth like poisoned spores. He shook his head in disbelief, and when he looked again, the bats had dispersed.
Did you see that?
He asked Jackie.
See what? She asked uninterestedly.
He knew there was no point in describing it. Yet the boldness of the vision, out here above the rail yard where anyone could see it, made him bristle with indignation. His strange encounter with the fawn was still fresh in his memory, but the odd twilight and the empty shopping centre reconciled more easily in his mind. Why shouldn't something strange have happened in that unpleasant place, with its deserted car park and blank aisles, no one to witness it? It was unquestionably real. Peter knew this because he had never had an imagination, never before and not now, and if he hadn't imagined Braith, then it followed very simply that he existed. Peter looked around for someone who could corroborate what he'd just seen, and noticed for the first time another inhabitant of the platform. He was a little way up, toward the blinking signal light, hunched forward on a bench and completely still. When they'd arrived on the platform, his shape had seemed to Peter to be a jumble of old boxes and newspaper. But now Peter saw it was a young man, very young, maybe even a teenager, with a tall, stooped frame, red hair and a head like a jar. As Peter noticed him, the man craned his head up and around and smiled benevolently.
Hello?
Peter called out.
Hey, pal?
The young red-headed man called back. Peter saw now that maybe he wasn't as young as Peter had first thought. It was hard to tell, actually. Not young, but not old either. His skin was dull and grey, with dark freckles that looked like they'd been painted on. He had a flat face and a curling smile, and wide-set eyes that glittered at Peter. Peter got up and made towards him, stopping hesitantly a few metres short of the man.
Did you?
He pointed at the sky.
Did you see that?
The redhead smirked.
Might have,
he croaked,
depending on what you think you saw. What's got you so rattled, pal? What's with the glum matter? Why the heavy footfalls?
The bats, Peter blurted. Did you see them? The way they were flying?
Oh, well.
The red-headed man gestured at the bench next to him.
Of course, the bats. Yeah, I saw them, little...
He flapped his hands like wings.
Flap, flap. Yes, everyone around here knows about the bats, if you'll allow me to consult my notes.
He lifted a heavy blue sports bag from the bench next to him and rifled through it with exaggerated gestures, making strange grunting sounds as he did so. At last he said,
Ah, here it is.
And lifted a thick notebook from the bag with exaggerated difficulty. He raised it horizontally to his face and pretended to blow dust from the cover. He looked at Peter and winked, then placed it in his lap and licked thumb and forefinger to open the page. As it lay there in his lap, Peter noticed an odd logo on the front, a star with a half circle.
What was it they did? Remind me.
A skull, Peter interjected eagerly. They were flying, and they made the shape of a skull.
The redhead nodded.
Are you waiting for a train?
Peter asked. And the redhead drummed his knees and asked Peter if he was wearing eyeliner.
A little eyeliner?
He asked, grasping Peter's head by his cheeks and tilting his face towards the light.
Something soft? Cheap? Such darkness under your eyes. Perhaps it's the hour.
He trailed off thoughtfully.
The month, the phase of the moon. Many explanations for a little darkness under your eyes, of course. Tell me, do you think that by simply observing the right combination and sequence of phenomena, you might be able to save your eternal soul? Just by observing, you understand, not participating. No, no,
he finished.
I'm not catching the train. I came to see the bats flying in the shape of a screaming skull.
Peter stamped his feet and whirled back towards Jackie.
Yes, he yelled. Yes, the scream. It was screaming. Did you hear?
Jackie was slouched where she sat, staring out dolefully at the orange-lit trees, and had missed Peter's conversation with the red-headed man.
"Incredible," Peter said. "Isn't it? If you knew it would happen, you must have seen it before. It can't be an accident. They must be doing it on purpose."
"Never said I'd seen it before,"
the red-headed man sang suddenly.
"Better be careful."
"Yes, I think you,
Peter stammered, and the redhead laughed, an unsettling high-pitched yelp. He stood up and bowed deeply.
"Would love to hear more about what you think,"
he said softly, staring at Peter. His eyes were wide and unblinking.
"Tell you what, come over here and I'll show you what you think."
Peter sat still as a statue.
"Come over here,"
the redhead sang softly. It was nearly a whisper now, and suddenly terrifying. Peter stood up and tottered unwillingly over to him, and the redhead unzipped his blue sports bag. Inside it, lying on a jumbled mess of banknotes, was a huge hunting knife, the blade nearly 30 centimetres long and 10 centimetres high from the edge to the top of the blade.
"I'll slice you open,"
the red-headed teen whispered.
"Got it? Don't tell anyone what you've seen. Understand?
Peter! Peter!"
he said, clicking his fingers in front of Peter's eyes.
"I'll empty you out. Get it?"
From the silence there came a twitching sound, like a whipping of wire, and the rails banged and hummed dully, and then as Peter listened with immense relief, a horn sounded down the line. The twitching rose and rose, and suddenly in the dark there were lights and rushing metal wheels, and the locomotive clanged into view, gleaming in the light of the station. Peter scurried back to Jackie and the luggage. He looked back at the bench and noticed with alarm that the redhead was gone. Peter shrank down. Had the redhead snuck up silently, blade clutched down low in jacket pocket, to empty him out? But he looked around and saw the platform was bare, and Peter remembered with relief that he'd said he wasn't getting on the train, only there to watch the bats. They boarded the train and trooped awkwardly through the aisle to their seats. Peter's eyes wandered forward. In front of them, separated by only a single empty row, was the red-headed man. Thanks for listening to The Horse and the Rider. It's written, read and produced by me, Max Laverne. I'd love to hear from you if you've been enjoying it. You can tweet at me, prawn_meat, or send me an email, maxlaverne@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can make a donation at ko-fi.com/Max Laverne. There's also a few copies left of my book of short stories, Blue Night at the Cult. If you're interested in any of this stuff, you can find the links in my link tree on Twitter. If you know anyone who's into the persuasive power of dreams, make sure you tell them about this podcast, because next week in episode 10, Peter has a dream which changes the way he feels about Jackie. So it's a great time to dream a little dream of Pete, as they might say.